Welcome to Coach on the Rise, the podcast for all coaches of all sports. This podcast is a True North Sports production with the simple purpose of building a community of coaches who want to learn together, grow together, and support each other. If you'd like to learn more about True North Sports, please look for our info in today's show notes. Thank you for joining us, and now on to our show.
Hey coaches, welcome to episode 14. I'm excited to be here and I'm your host for this episode, Ramat Olson. In today's podcast, we'll hear from Len Zukowski, the co-author of The Playmaker's Advantage, How to Raise Your Mental Game to the Next Level. He is also a longtime professor at Boston University, although he is retired now, and a pioneer in the field of sports psychology. Len's focus has been to raise awareness on cognition, which is a thinking process in human performance, and also how athletes make decisions. This has revolutionized the way that athletics is viewed throughout the country. Once again, we just wanted to say a big thank you to all the coaches and the people who attended Camp Elevate and made it a success. We hope you enjoyed it as much as we did, and we hope to see you guys next year. For more information about True North Sports or to listen to our other podcasts, visit our website, www.truenorthsports.net. Now, let's head back to the podcast. We're going to dive right on in with Celia Slater as our interviewer.
Today, I have the privilege of visiting with Dr. Len Zukowski, who was the longtime professor at Boston University and who many people call one of the pioneers in sports performance and sports psychology. I'm really thrilled to be talking to him today, and he's just released a new book called The Playmaker's Advantage, How to Raise Your Mental Game to the Next Level. And I am very excited to get this book and read it. And I can't tell you, Len, how excited I am to have met you with Liz Hansen at the recent conference that you were at. So
it's mutual.
We bumped into each other. That was fantastic. Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit about your background? Because I know you're retired now in Fort Myers, got tired of those winters in Boston, huh?
Yes.
And, so you and your wife retired down in Fort Myers, but can you tell us a little bit about your background, how you kind of got that path into that sports performance, sports psychology world?
Well, there's surely a difference in geography. I grew up in northern Alberta, about 800 miles north of the Montana border. So people just think there's just tundra up there. It was a wonderful place to grow up and play lots of sports. We had long summers. Winters were great for playing hockey. And my ambition was to be a coach and a teacher. And high school was just kind of my aspiration. And when I graduated from the University of Alberta, I got a position in a wonderful high school in the central part of Alberta, and was doing what I love, teaching and coaching. Not only high school athletes, but also the semi-pro level in baseball and hockey with grown adults, and at a pretty young age. But I realized very quickly, Celia, that the training that I received back in those days, that was 50-some years ago, and you know, some of it hasn't changed, but the emphasis was pretty much on physiology, training the human body, and doing that well. Strength and conditioning wasn't even a specialty then, but it was all around human physiology. And being a good teacher, the pedagogy of teaching and coaching. And I realized very quickly in coaching at all levels that what was missing is my understanding of psychology. So I was off to the University of Oklahoma to get my master's in emphasizing psychology, and was there that a professor had an influence on my thinking process and said, well, you're pretty good at this stuff. Why don't you get a PhD? And my question was, well, what's that? And off I went to, with their help, to the University of Toledo, where I was able to do very much an interdisciplinary PhD that emphasized kind of the psychology, performance, the skill acquisition part. I spent a year at the medical school trying to understand the brain, which in those days was kind of unheard of. It was called neuroanatomy in those days, and now it's neuroscience. And the good thing is we know a lot more about neuroscience, but the structure of the brain hasn't changed that much in the time frame. So that was my focus. I was able to get the kind of training I wanted. And that kind of pushed me out of the high school area. It was on to looking for positions in higher education. and I did get a one-year job offer to go to Boston University that fortunately turned into 38 wonderful years where I could do what I really envisioned doing, and that was creating a graduate training program in sports psychology that emphasized the counseling component as well. So I had a great run there, not only teaching graduate students about the field, but also the university allowed me to do consulting with high performance teams at the pro level, the Olympic level. And my passion still was with young kids. So we spent a lot of time working with kids. And then when you have your own, it's a, yeah, you really get embedded with that. So that was kind of my long, wonderful run at Boston University. And I haven't given up on trying to inform the professionals and the general public about the importance of cognition, the thinking process, and human performance at all levels.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Wow. What a great career path. What a great career. And I think what's interesting is, like you said, you've worked on a lot of different levels, from the professional level, college level, and maybe even younger. Like, do you notice some really distinct differences, like from those different levels, or are all of them really struggling with the same stuff, just at a different level?
Yeah, at different levels. Yeah, for sure it's different. And one of the messages we try to portray in the book is that it depends on who we're talking to. Are we talking to elite athletes? Are we talking to high school and age athletes or youth level athletes? And certainly it depends on what level parents are more involved. They're going to be much more involved with the youngsters, and a little more so at the college level. And I learned that even at the pro level, parents don't leave their sons and daughters behind. That's pretty amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure now even more so the parents are much different on the pro level, I'm sure.
Yeah, and I think we try to portray in the book kind of take-home messages for those three populations, the athletes themselves, the coaches, young and established coaches, and the parents, where there's a lot of myths that have been perpetuated as to how their youngster could become a playmaker or a good athlete.
That's awesome. Well, let's jump in and talk a little bit about the book. Well, it seems to be kind of a passion project for you, and you were sharing with me some of the interviews you did, like with Brad Stevens with the Celtics and for this book. But tell us a little bit about what would be some of the key takeaways if somebody were to get this book. What would it be?
Again, it's going to depend upon whether they're reading it as a parent and take home messages for them as parents, and what are the important take homes that they should learn from that. Whether it's the athlete themselves who's now at, say, the high school level, or college level, and even for some of the pros, what are some of the take home messages on how to train to be the best, to be the next playmaker. And of course, with coaches who you work a lot with, emphasizing to them to be a little more self-aware of what their limitations are. And I'm sure many of them were like me in my early days, of having that self-awareness that I just didn't know the psychology performance very well. And my mission was to try to better understand it. And as Mike Sullivan, one of my students at Boston University, who's won two consecutive Stanley Cups with the Pittsburgh Penguins, missed out this year, wrote so eloquently in the foreword to the book of why this is so important. It was something that he learned later as a player and early in his career as a coach, that he needed to better understand the thinking process of young athletes and pro athletes, how they think and how they learn, because that informs how they're going to teach. So Mike did a great job, and I cite him several times throughout the book as well, as one of these forward-thinking coaches who can really make a difference, not only in the sport of hockey, but coaches love to learn from each other, regardless of the sport that they're involved in.
For sure, definitely. Well, when you were talking to me about what Brad Stevens shared with you about the playmakers and his perspective on playmakers, would you mind sharing that with our audience?
Yes, I've known Brad for some years now when I was still in the Boston area, and he first joined the Celtics as head coach. I had the privilege of meeting him. So we knew each other prior to doing the interview. But after he got his teeth into being with the Celtics for a number of years, he was so gracious in helping us better understand the idea of the playmaker. And Dan Peterson, my co-author, and I both thought that for sure, you know, it was the point guards with the playmakers on the Celtics. He says, no, you got it wrong. It was Al Horford. He was the engine that made us run. He our go-to person, performed under pressure all the time, most of the time. And there were other coaches that told us the same thing. I learned that from another wonderful coach in a very different sport. And my connections to Australia and the Australian rules football, and John Langmaier, the coach of the Sydney Swans. Same kind of thing. You know, I thought I understood who their playmaker was, and you got that wrong. And he talked about what they do. It's much like Brad Stevens said. It's everything kind of, they make everything run. And they're the go-to person. They perform in clutch situations and all pressure situations. And everybody else kind of rallies around them, and they play much better because of those individuals. So it's a pretty universal thing that we discovered in all our many interviews across a lot of team sports around the world.
So, Len, would you say that when you're talking about the term playmaker, you're also really talking about maybe the heart of the team or the culture contributor, the main person who helps build that culture, or also the team builder kind of aspect? Is that another way you would call the playmaker?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question. It's got an interesting title for the book. I think when probably people see it in a bookstore, they'll say, what's that? But they don't have to think very long. Anybody who's around sports, they kind of know what the meaning is. And we tried to use that term rather than what was evident in the early academic research, where they call these people who are the kind of the outstanding players, call them experts. Well, yeah, it's a hard thing to kind of conceptualize in the world of sport. We can call them champions. My wonderful student David Henry, back in the mid 80s, started writing about who these excellent people were, Olympic champions and pro champions consistently over time. He just kind of called them champions because that's what we refer to in the world of sport. But Dan and I thought we'd put a little different twist on it and call these people the playmakers. And it's so interesting, again, to get definitions that are pretty universal, some variations on it. And we talked to not only coaches, but we talked to athletes themselves, and they could kind of self-describe either themselves or others in their sport who are what they would define as the playmakers. And we talked to academics like my good friend Anders Ericsson, who talked about the deliberate practice notion. And we also talked to other writers and authors, like David Epstein, who wrote that wonderful book, The Sports Gene, that get their take on how they would define the playmaker. And David Epstein talked about Dennis Rodman, that nobody, with that great team in Chicago. And he says, you know, as I watched the Chicago team all the years, yeah, Rodman drew attention to himself, but he was just simply the best rebounder by far, not even close. Yeah. And so that was an interesting take, that it doesn't have to be the Michael Jordan scoring all the points or the Scottie Pippen. And he raised a very good point. So every team has their variation on this playmaker.
And yet, would you say that if you don't have one, it's probably pretty tough to win?
You're absolutely right. Yeah, I think it's almost like the on-court, on-field coach. This is kind of the take-charge person. And you see that. And I spent a better part of a day with Sidney Crosby at training camp for last September in Pittsburgh. And a very humble individual. But you can see clearly that why he is the playmaker and his devotion to mastering the game, even though he's been in the league for a number of years, but also helping youngsters like Jay Getzko become an outstanding player in his own right.
Yeah, so do you think that's part of the role with the playmaker? Do you talk about the way they mentor or...
For sure.
...role model for the younger players as they come into the system?
For sure. And boy, I can't recall that we ever encountered somebody who would be classified as a playmaker who wasn't this humble. You have to have a bit of an ego for sure to be the best, but they really cared about everybody else and making them better. Just wonderful human beings as players.
And your time in working with a lot of head coaches in your career, what were some of the common mistakes that you would see head coaches make?
Again, I'm just going to refer to the levels. You know, with youth coaches, the biggest mistake they make is because they were not trained. It's not entirely their fault. They weren't trained to be coaches necessarily. They're bankers or dentists or MDs or whatever they are. And they believe this is all about strategy and X's and O's and don't recognize this as an important teaching dimension and learning dimension. And they model what happens at the elite level, primary the pro level. That's what they see on television. That's how you coach. You holler and scream and mistakenly believe that the youngster is just a miniature adult and not understanding that they learn very differently. You have to teach very differently. So if you haven't been taught to be a teacher, this is hard, but that's typically who our youngsters get. And as we move up the performance ladder in the coaches at the collegiate level and at the pro level, I find it similar that many of them struggle with the idea of, and more so at the pro level, the idea of maintaining that arm's length relationship with players. And I know in your work, you that whole notion of communication and relationship building is vital. Mm-hmm. They don't recognize that. So that's, to me, that always has jumped out at me, that they want to maintain that distance. And it's almost like they want players to be guessing what they're thinking as opposed to telling them straight out. So that is the single biggest flaw I've seen at the, particularly the pro level, to some extent at the collegiate level too. They want to maintain that arm's length relationship when in fact should be embracing the whole idea of developing strong relationships with their athletes. And in my opinion, they're not going to be compromising anything. But at the pro level, it's that wonderful guessing game they want to have players try to figure out what they're thinking. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a tragic mistake.
I agree. It's like, what can be more important than building relationships with your players and really understanding what makes them tick? And you have to open up a little bit. And I think part of it is they just think it's a level of vulnerability. They're not willing to go down that path. And for whatever reason, it compromises them with their relationship. But again, like you and I got in a little bit of a conversation, you know, I'm at the belief that we have to professionalize the coaching profession. You know, I feel like coaches are learning how to coach. They're training themselves how to become coaches by going to conferences and reading books. And I really believe we need to start requiring coaches to get a degree in coaching. And people have to get a license, and they can lose that license. If they have poor moral character, they should lose their coaching license and never be able to coach again. And the good ones we should reward. And I'm just curious, like, what you think about that and working with all these coaches. Like, don't you think it would be better if we prepared coaches in the skill sets that help them work with people?
Absolutely. And again, that has been ignored. And the responsibility of going beyond the sport itself and molding them as wonderful character people. We get some of these bad characters in as coaches. You say, that how do we exclude them? And yes, there are very few coach training programs, and many, you know, as you are aware of, national governing bodies in this country have tried to ratchet up their coach training, but it's somewhat hit and miss. Canada, Australia, UK has gone more systematically into coach education. We in the United States, that has not really happened.
Yeah.
Well, I think the performance part, because we have such a large number of wonderful athletes and some good coaches, we can get by with it. But I think it would be a journey well taken to get into professional coach education programs.
Yeah, for sure. And what if, you know, I work with a lot of really young coaches, Len, and I was wondering if you had advice for some of the young coaches that you see as assistant coaches, and what are some of the mistakes that you see them make as they're trying to move up the ladder or whatnot. Do you have any suggestions for our younger coaches as they start out their careers?
Well, it's what you mentioned earlier, that having that what we call, Carol Dweck mentioned, the growth mindset, that they, many of them perhaps think they know it all already. They played the sport perhaps in many cases. And how hard is it to be a coach, you know? But they've never had any classes in coaching pedagogy. So if they have that growth mindset, and they never stop learning, and we start right now, this is what we're getting into. What else do I have to know? You know, the great John Wooden, I had the pleasure of meeting him, spending a day with him about 7 or 8 years before he passed away. But he was just such a wonderful human being to talk to. And he's written about this too, so, but I quizzed him on it also too, his constant desire to learn. And so, and back then the seasons weren't 12 months, essentially like they are now, but he'd use the summer to go spend time with outstanding coaches to learn something that he felt he was a little bit weak on, and spend the summer with them. Next summer, go work on another skill set that he could improve the UCLA Bruins with. So here's probably the greatest coach of all time who had that growth mindset. And you would think we would learn lessons from somebody like a John Wooden. And one of them is to constantly want to grow. You never stop learning. And so that's my advice to young coaches: get in, read a lot, go to formal seminars, even some things outside of your field. That doesn't have to always be about coaching methodology and the X's and O's, or running certain kinds of zone defenses or whatever it might be. It's learn about other fields beyond coaching, and particularly in the business world, in the leadership area, but also from great teachers and kind of the art and science of being a good teacher, because that's what you really are. And we forget that we're not teachers first and foremost.
One of the coaches who teaches in our program, her name is Becky Burley, and she's the soccer coach here at the University of Florida. And one of the things that she really believes in and promotes in her program is this concept of empathy. And she believes if empathy is present, it really dissolves judgment in your program. So when athletes are judging each other and being harsh on each other or competing with one another, that the higher you can have them have empathy, then that kind of takes that away. And I'm curious what you think about that, because I've also heard from experts such as Dr. Tim Elmore on the concept that empathy is a skill set that this generation struggles with. So as these younger athletes are coming through, empathy is not a skill set that they have, just based on their iPhones and their life that they have. So I'm curious on what your thoughts are on that, if you've ever found that to be true in your research and what you've done.
Oh, for sure. I agree with you wholeheartedly. We've, because of what's happened with our social media presence, that skill set of lack of communication, talking directly one-on-one with people, and rather on computers and machines and tablets and iPhones, that's missing. And I think it's to our detriment. And I think there may be people that believe that empathy works against you in the world of sports. You got to win at all costs. And nothing can be further from the truth. You can switch back and forth. You can show this great empathy for your teammates, like even, and sometimes the opposition too. But while you're in competition, you're beating up on each other. And that's okay. You can do that. And it always has been. Again, I just want to dissuade the people who believe that if you're always showing empathy, you never develop that killer instinct. And yet there's so many wonderful examples of individuals who were very aggressive performers. And I think of my days in Boston, like Terry O'Reilly of the Boston Bruins. He, not overly talented man, but just tenacious and physical. And yet that game is over and he just turns into this kind of gentle giant. And I think everybody's capable of doing that. We just have to learn that skill set. Mm-hmm. On the playing field, that you're this tenacious individual, and then you get off the field and you can have this wonderful empathy towards your family and others.
Because, yeah, I think it's really interesting how do you walk that line of trying to get your athletes to compete with one another and yet be teammates?
Yes.
Because that's a really tough place because, you know, some coaches really pit their athletes against each other and yet they want them to be teammates and create a positive team culture. Yeah. It just seems like those two things do not go together.
Yeah. It presents a dilemma. They're obsessed with this training, this mental toughness and thinking that it's an all by itself and that you can't switch over to being an empathetic individual and still be mentally tough.
Mm-hmm. If there were like the main thing, like I work mainly with collegiate coaches and you know, what would be their biggest things that they would get from reading your book? What would be some of the things that would really help them?
I would hope there would be a self-awareness of their limitations and understanding this field, reading more about how they can get into the things we talk about quite a bit, is that kind of seeing the field, the ice, the pitch in a better way. How can we train that perceptual processes so they can attend to the most relevant cues? That's huge. So we spend quite a bit of time on that. And then it's how do we train decision making so that the athletes can make better decisions, quicker decisions? And that's kind of the big theme of the book, is the decision making process. And so often we don't give them experience and practice at making decisions. Coaches are always making decisions, as you know. Well, we have to train the athletes to be able to make independent decisions too. So it's the decision making and then the execution part, that they have to be able to execute through deliberate practice. Now, I think some of the more creative coaches, like a Mike Sullivan I mentioned earlier, have figured out in soccer. Soccer's been doing this for years. To enhance the decision-making process of athletes, and that's to do your drills in tight areas. That forces them to make quicker decisions and more accurate decisions. And it's interesting, I've asked a number of coaches when I see them doing these tight area drills, I ask them, so why are you doing this? Well, they're pretty with the young kids. Well, they need more touches on the ball. And and not one ever mentioned the fact, oh, I'm trying to speed up their decision-making process. So we've got to educate. I'm going to, you know, one of the take-home lessons from the book, I'm hoping, is that they'll get this awareness. Yeah, this area is really important. And how can I creatively, these are smart people, how can I creatively set up drills that will speed up the decision-making process? It's almost like in hockey, we had this notion physiologically of overspeed training. So the youngsters would skate as fast as they can and not fall down. And when they fall down, it's okay, just get up. But really train yourself to go as fast as you can in these tight areas. Well, this is the same concept. It's overspeed training for the brain. So you want to put them in situations where they have to think faster and make their own decisions. Mm-hmm. So that's huge. And I think one of the things we tried to emphasize too, in what I think it was chapter 3, where we talked about, it's kind of what gets measured is what's important. And as we know, if we look at the pro model or the collegiate level, they look at the, you know, the physical fitness, the strength, speed, and those kinds of parameters. We've always been able to measure them. But now we have cognitive abilities that can be measured. And I can just mention a few of them. For example, the good friend Scott Goldman has developed the AIQ, Athlete Intelligence Quotient, that's getting a lot of traction at the collegiate and pro level to try to get at the cognitive abilities of a young athlete and then find out what their strengths and weaknesses are and then go ahead and train it. Mm-hmm. So we're now capable of at least asking the question, do they have cognitive abilities to excel at this sport and be the next playmaker? And then so if not, what are their deficiencies and how can we train them? And so we talk about different methods of training that I've been involved in for a long, long time. You know, one is this whole notion of tight area drills, but now there's technology, Celia, that's available that can train our young athletes and the pro athletes to acquire these skills. So for instance, I've been involved in biofeedback most of my life and believing that's an important training tool for teaching athletes how to monitor stress responses in their lives. But now, you don't have to have big expensive equipment. We have small apps that go on tablets and phones that can teach you to slow down your breathing, control your heart rate and respiration, It's wonderful tools. So that's available. That wasn't around not that many years ago. When I was working in pro hockey in Vancouver in 2010, I introduced multiple object tracking to train attentional focus. And I think there are a lot of folks thought, I'm nuts. But now it's really gained a lot of traction. And there's a tool called a neuro tracker that they use for training attentional focus. Again, it's through technology. And the third one that I'm a big fan of and hope coaches can be more aware of is using the scientifically validated method of visual occlusion to train decision-making. And so I've been involved with colleagues and developed a pitch recognition app for baseball and softball, and it's going to go beyond to other sports, where basically you occlude the pitch and have to determine whether it's going to be a fastball, breaking ball, or changeup, whether it's a strike or a ball. But it forces you to pay attention to relevant cues from real pitchers off of video. So there are these technological advances that are available in 2018 that we've tried to alert the readers to. And if they want to learn, then let's see if we can apply it.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any plans for creating like some online classes to go with your books? I know you're retired as a teacher, but do you have any desire to do any more of that as in your world right now? Because you know virtual learning's big, Len.
Oh, I know. Yeah, we may just very well do that. We'll see how what kind of traction we get, and we're hoping it'll be good and with help from people like you that make this known to the general sporting population, which is huge. Mm-hmm. That we're in the business of educating them, and we'll do it whatever way we can. And that's how I want to kind of end my career is kind of continue being an educator and bring this to the attention of parents and athletes and coaches. This is an important area that's been overlooked for half a century.
Yeah, I've always been really fascinated too with the whole concept of confidence, because, yes. I've always been like, you have these two athletes, and both of them shoot 300 shots a day, and yet one of them just doesn't have the confidence the other one does. And where does that come from, this level of confidence? And seriously, if there could be a pill or a drill to help develop that.
Pill or a drill.
A pill or a drill, in our country, you would make $1 million for sure.
Well, we talk about that in one of our latter chapters. And one of my great professional colleagues that so many people in the field know of, Albert Bandura at Stanford University, he's a fellow Canadian who is the most cited psychologist alive today. He's in his 90s, but he's written so much about self-efficacy and its application to sport performance. And I wrote in the book, if there was a playmaker in psychology, it would be Albert Bandura. Mm-hmm. And just a wonderful man who's taught us so much about the importance of self-efficacy or confidence and how we can build on it. So we write a little bit about Bandura's position on how we develop this confidence once you lose it.
Mm-hmm. There's this, we do a lot with our coaches on their life story and how their life story really impacts the coach that they are. Like everything that they've experienced in their life to this moment has really shaped them and their values and their beliefs and their beliefs about themselves. And we talk about their story bag, their life story. Yeah. And what are some of the really great things from their story bag? And what are some of the heavy things in their story bag that they need to lighten up and let go of, or to be the best coach that they can be? And then we remind them that all of their athletes come to them with their own story bag.
Sure.
And so that's part of the fascination for me, is that athlete that comes to you with that story bag that might be really affecting their confidence and their self-image and their belief in themselves or lack of belief in themselves. So I find it fascinating. That's part of that whole team culture process. When you get all these people, and breaking through and managing all those people and building relationships with all those people, and how well do you know those athlete story bags?
Yeah, and have they stopped having fun? We got to continue emphasizing that. And I can't remember if I mentioned any of our earlier questions about take-home messages to parents, that we really pushed hard on this notion of early specialization. Don't get into that trap. And every athlete we interviewed said they played a variety of sports, and that's, they wouldn't change a thing. And how much they learned of the transfer from other sports, not only athleticism, but that whole cognitive function that we've been talking about, how they see the field, how they make decisions, and how they execute. So that was a big take-home message that we laid out for the parents.
It's such a great point, because I played three sports in high school, and I'm definitely a dying breed and a dying.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
And I think it's just, in fact, I look back on it, I wish I would have played two sports in college, you know. Yep. But I think that it's so much become about money now. Like all the club teams are making so much money dangling this carrot, you know, of the college scholarship that really is probably about 2% of the kids that participate in those club sports are probably going to get those big scholarships.
Yeah. And the money so many parents put into the sporting education of their youngsters to get that opportunity, probably they could easily pay for the tuition.
Yeah.
Without the scholarship.
It's so true. They really could have. It's just this little thing that everybody's a little gerbil running on that round thing. Everybody's doing it, so everybody else is going to do it. So
terrific.
Hopefully we can switch that model for sure sometime down the road. Well, let me just ask you this, Len, looking back on your career, is there any advice you would give to your younger self looking back that you would do differently or do the same? Or what advice would you give your younger self?
I've been asked that question in slightly different ways, Celia, but I'll tell you, I had one of the great runs in life. I couldn't imagine trading it for anything. As Yogi Berra said, you come to the fork in the road and you take it. And I managed to take the right fork in the road pretty much every time, like from going on to graduate school and then ending up in Boston when I was kind of the first of its kind in that area and had opportunities to do the things I did. Both as a researcher, as an educator, and as a consultant to different levels of sport, different sport governing bodies, traveling the world. One of my great experiences is working with the Spanish World Cup team in 2006 and in 2008 in the European Championships. Just experiences I couldn't have received without being where I was and trying to make a difference to sport around the world. Getting to know a lot of good people like you, mm-hmm. and developing relationships that help open doors. And so, no, I can't think of a thing that I would change. Everything's fallen in pretty well for me. No one traded for anything, and I've just had a great run, and I hope it continues for another decade or so, and I can make, you know, at least one final contribution, maybe another, with the notion that we try to relate in this book, the importance of cognition to develop the outstanding athlete.
Fantastic. I just was going to ask you, when you came to those fork in the road, those different forks in the road in your life, we call our company True North Sports for a
reason. Yes, yes.
We talk to the coaches a lot about following their internal compass. And do you remember thinking through those processes? Like, was it an intuitive choice for you? Was there just a process that you would go to make that decision which way to go on the fork? Or was it really clear to you most of the time which way to go?
Most of the time, I thought it was pretty clear that it has to be a thoughtful decision. Like, do I go back to teaching and coaching at the high school level, which was so wonderful, or do I do what some professors said to do, is that you can make a greater impact for more people by training others to do what you're doing? And that was a wise bit of advice, and I agree with it and pursued it. But then once I got there, you've got to have a growth mindset before we called it that. And I wanted to always grow, be better at what I did, and make sure I met the best people in the world at doing what I'm doing, whether it was in the world of sport or outside of the world of sport. Such I learned a lot from surgeons and others who I've consulted with on how they can be high performers or playmakers in their field. So you learn from them as well. So I always had that growth mindset. That was purposeful. Some of it, yeah, who you run into can be by accident, mm-hmm. but the idea was to kind of keep learning.
Mm-hmm. And in the world of college of athletics right now, what would you say has you most concerned in the world of college athletics?
Well, the fact that big money has kind of taken over. We talked about that a little earlier. That's most unfortunate. It's more the athlete student now rather than the student athlete, unfortunately. I think it's not repairable. I think kind of many of us older generation, we say kind of the golden era of collegiate athletics where it was kind of truly amateur, and not so sure it is anymore. And in this country, it is for sure the training ground for developing a professional athletes. And that wasn't the original mission. We go back in time, but that's what it's become. And it's driven by money, of course. And I think that's most unfortunate.
Yeah. Well, Len, you have been teaching, you taught for many years, and I can only imagine, you know, you're kind of like this pebble that hits the water, and you've got this ripple effect of just people that you've affected over the years and touched and trained and taught. And you've got so many people out there doing your work that must make you feel really proud, you know, to see how you have impacted the big picture of sports psychology and cognitive and performance. And how does that feel to you to know that you've left quite a legacy in your profession?
I never thought of it that way, Celia, but more and more in the last few years, I get reminded by my former students where I meet up with them at conferences and elsewhere. I just never thought that I had the impact that I did. I was doing my job, but maybe it's turned into I did a pretty good job of training some really outstanding people who are going well beyond what I ever did as an academic and as a consultant. They're going well beyond that. And that's the purpose of all of this, that they should kind of carry the torch and do bigger and better things. And I'm glad so many of them are. And they're not only here in North America, but they're all over the world. And I'd have to say I'm most pleased about that. That's the contribution I made to their development.
And if your students, colleagues, and friends out there were to say three words that they would use to describe you, what do you think those three words would be?
Well, I think knowledge might be one. My honesty, sense of humor. You got to have that.
Got to have a sense of humor, right, yeah, for sure. Yeah, I would say one of the words that came to mind for me just talking to you and getting to know you is collaborator. And definitely a teacher. You're a teacher, for sure. At the core of who you are, you're a teacher.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, that is the highest compliment. That's what I set out to be, and I believe that's what I did, for mm-hmm. sure. And it's going to continue one way or another, whether it's going to be with webinars like this or teaching courses or engaging in another book that kind of expands upon what we did with the Playmaker's Advantage.
Yeah. I have one last question for you. I'm curious about gender differences in your work and if you found any between the two genders.
Did I find any? Yeah, for sure. At all levels, from working with young kids when I was teaching school and working with junior high youngsters, males and females, and right through consulting at the collegiate level and at the pro level with women athletes, that the biggest difference that always jumped out at me is the sensitivity of females at all levels. Mm-hmm. Take criticism quite personally, whether it comes from their coach, but particularly from their teammates. That always has jumped out at me and remains that way to this day. The girls are just more sensitive and get very upset, whereas guys typically really insult each other, and it kind of runs off their back and they're friends immediately. It takes a little time to bring that trust back again. That's the one thing, the big thing that's always jumped out at me.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we'll have to do a whole nother podcast on that maybe.
Yeah, sure. Well, thanks so much, Celia, for doing this.
Well, I really appreciate it. I really look forward to reading your book, The Playmaker's Advantage, How to Raise Your Mental Game. It's available everywhere right now. So coaches, I would highly recommend you take a look at this book and see if it can help you have a few more tools in your toolkit.
Exactly.
Well, thank you, Len. I really appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
It's been a pleasure meeting you.
Yes, and we'll make a run to Gainesville here one day. We'll catch up again.
That would be fantastic. I would love that.
I want to thank you for listening in. If this podcast has added value to your day, I just ask that you do two things. Share it with a friend in the coaching world, and if you're so inclined, go ahead and subscribe to the podcast. The more people we can add to this wonderful coaching tribe, the better for everyone. Thank you, Len and Celia, for taking the time out of your day to participate in this podcast and giving us such a great show. Once again, thank you for listening to Coaches on the Rise, a True North Sports podcast. I'm Amal Hassan, and I've been your host.